Welcome to STEMversity, the podcast, produced by the NSF-HSI National STEM Resource Hub. This podcast engages conversations with STEM experts at various stages in their careers, working for diversifying the scientific enterprise in an equitable way. Our guest panelists share perspectives and experiences as they tackle concerns and celebrate successes we often engage as we work to support students pursuing STEM degrees at Hispanic-serving institutions. Your host is the president of Doña Ana Community College in Las Cruces, New Mexico, Dr. Monica Torres. For more information, visit the HSI National STEM Resource Hub website at www.hsistemhub.org. Today's podcast guest is Dr. Michelle Schuster from New Mexico State University. In this episode, Dr. Torres and Dr. Schuster discuss using data to assess the effectiveness of inclusive teaching, combating stereotype threat in the classroom, the scholarship of teaching, equity in higher education, and institutional investments and conventions for supporting faculty for bolstering student success. Stay tuned for today's podcast.
Welcome, Michelle. Thank you for joining us today. You know, we've worked in the same university and the same system for a number of years now, and our paths have crossed from time to time. I'm thrilled that finally we're able to have a conversation about the kind of issues that we'll talk about today. So thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I've really been looking forward to this conversation.
I'd like to start, Michelle, by asking you about your work as a scientist. Can you describe for our audience your research and your teaching interests, and maybe then tell us a little bit about how you got to that professional and academic space? We'd like to hear more about you.
All right. Well, I always say that I have a very nonlinear or curvy path to have gotten where I am. So I'm glad you asked about the path, because that gives some context. So I started off, I think, on a pretty traditional path. So I was a biology major as an undergrad, and I did my undergrad at Queen's University in Canada. And I had the opportunity to do some undergraduate research. And then I moved and I went to grad school at Tufts University in Boston, in the biomedical sciences graduate school. And I was in the molecular microbiology program. But unlike everybody else in the department who studied bacteria, we studied yeast, which are eukaryotic organisms. And I actually studied how their chromosomes segregate during meiosis, which is the same process that can go wrong and result in something like Down syndrome in humans. So I got very fascinated by chromosomes. I loved chromosomes. I ended up having a disastrous thesis. Well, okay, it wasn't disastrous. I learned a lot, but it was totally not what we thought was going on the entire time. In the end, I ended up having this circular chromosome that explained like all of my results, but that's not what we were expecting. But then I got really curious about chromosome structure and oddball looking chromosomes. So then I went to University of Pittsburgh and I did a postdoc in oral cancer cytogenetics. So that's the study of chromosome structure in oral cancer. And because people who have oral cancer, it's often associated with tobacco use, which can break DNA. So it causes these really aberrant and wacky chromosomes, which in a way are beautiful when you use this technology to image them. And we were trying to figure out if certain alterations in chromosomes would be prognostic of like a poor outcome or a better outcome. So we would know like which patients might need sort of a tighter or more serious intervention earlier in their diagnosis, say. So I did lots with chromosomes, beautiful chromosomes, but then I also had the opportunity during that postdoc to teach a night class in human genetics at Chatham College, which was also in Pittsburgh. It was a small liberal arts women's college, and I taught a summer night course. It meant every Friday for 4 hours during the summer at night. So you knew there were dedicated students who were showing up to learn about human genetics at night. And basically that experience changed my life. I loved teaching. I loved teaching even more than I loved chromosomes. And that is saying something. So I then was able to get a position in the biology department at Pitt as a non-tenure track, 100% teaching faculty member. So I taught ginormous classes. I taught upper division classes. I taught a whole variety of classes. But at the same time, my spouse is also sort of a cell and molecular biologist, and his postdoc advisor moved to Boston. And so we had to sort of coordinate the challenges of two people trying to figure all this out. So I actually, when I moved to Boston, I spent 2 years working in a patent law firm. And so my organizational skills and my writing skills came in handy. But I really missed teaching. I mean, there was a little bit of education because I could meet with an inventor and kind of go over, okay, well, here's what you need. Here's the arguments we need to make. Let me tell you, help you. So there was some teaching, but it wasn't the same as students. And so when Brad got the job at NMSU, I was lucky enough to get another non-tenure track, 100% teaching position. So I did a lot of teaching. But I also worked with a colleague to start doing a little bit of scholarship in teaching and learning. So try and look at some of the strategies we were using. Were they working? Were they not working? And then on the basis of that, I was converted to the tenure track, started my tenure clock from zero. But I was able to get tenure. And then eventually I was promoted to full professor on the basis of the scholarship of teaching and learning. And right now my position is still heavier on teaching. So my allocation of effort is heavier than my colleagues on teaching. And I would consider my scholarship to be pretty applied. So what works in the classroom, how do we know it works, or providing resources for other instructors. So I write case studies that get peer reviewed and published. I'm the lead author on a textbook that gets extensively reviewed. And that's for people teaching non-majors, and it takes a more story-based approach to teaching biology. And that's where I'm at.
That's great. What an incredible story.
What a windy path.
It is a windy path. I'm glad you traveled the path, Michelle, because I do know from previous exposure to your work that it's made a difference for students at New Mexico State.
I took some risks, right? Giving up the job in patent law, which paid a lot of money, but it wasn't my passion. It wasn't my heart. And so what I sometimes say to students is, you know, you need to balance. Like, yes, you need to be able to support yourself and you need to have that stability and security to the extent you can, but you also need, I think, to try and follow your passion because you need to like what you do, because otherwise, what's the point?
You know, there are a couple things. One is, I think your history talks about two passions at least, right? You know, chromosomes and teaching. And a second point that I think is interesting when I think about institutions is that institutions don't always recognize scholarship of teaching and teaching as a scholarly pursuit.
After I started, NMSU formally adopted the Boyer model, recognizing scholarship versus research, even though I know they're used interchangeably. And so the typical sort of biological research that I was doing with the chromosomes would have been scholarship of discovery. And so that would be the traditional research. But then for me, I elected for the scholarship of teaching and learning. And that's... So it's interesting sort of what people, some people consider certain things to quote unquote count versus not count. But one of the things about scholarship is that it has to be open to the public, right? It has to be open to critique. You have to share it. So it's beyond just taking a scholarly approach to one's own teaching. It goes beyond using just your own classroom results to improve your class. That's definitely scholarly teaching. My impression is it crosses the line to scholarship when you put it out there in some way for other people to use, to comment on, to adopt. And so that's kind of what makes it scholarship, I think.
This idea of review that
yeah.
is publicly available for review of,
yes.
of some sort. That's great. Thanks. That's quite a nice distinction. There are scholarly approaches to teaching, but there's a scholarship affiliated with teaching.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
That's nice. Thank you. Your career speaks to at least two significant commitments. I'm going to have to add three to that. One is chromosomes, now that I know. But two of the other commitments that you've got are student success in your classroom and in science education more generally, and then equity in higher education. So I'd like to ask a few questions that I think are at the intersection of those commitments. So there's been a lot of historical and contemporary data that show that there are some populations that are not well represented in STEM professions. And so some of the ones that we think about are historically that's included women, first generation college students, students who come from low income settings, students from historically marginalized racial and ethnic backgrounds. The fields of science, I think, have been concerned about this for some time. And over the last several decades, there have been a number of agencies and organizations that have been encouraging and supporting faculty and staff to create more robust learning environments for students from a full range of backgrounds as a strategy for addressing historical inequities and to ultimately diversify the STEM workforce. So your work over the years has made you an expert in science education. How has this disciplinary interest in diversifying the STEM student population and the STEM workforce, how has that interest changed science education over the last period of time? What are the developments you've seen or are seeing that you think are trying to positively impact the numbers for diverse student populations in STEM and ultimately the workforce?
If we go back, something that's now being talked about for a long time, but when it was first introduced seemed somewhat radical, was just an emphasis on active and student-centered learning. So just stepping away from the lecture and letting students practice and learn and do in the classroom, work with the material. So we have a pretty long history of active learning being effective, helping students who have traditionally not done as well in our courses or not being retained in our courses. And so that was sort of an early emphasis, was, you know, active and student-centered learning. I think now we're starting to see a shift. What else can we do to make the teaching and learning process more inclusive? So I would say inclusive teaching and learning is now coming to the forefront. And so that still includes aspects of active learning, but also like how you might deliver it, how you can provide more flexibility and options for students, for example. I also think the field is starting to think sort of beyond the content. So it used to be you would see a lot of things. Here's an activity designed to help students master whatever, cellular respiration. But now we're starting to think beyond just how do students master the content, but what else can we do in terms of inclusivity in our classroom? And so we're starting to see people think about interventions, for example, that can mitigate stereotype threat or minimize test anxiety, which in turn can have positive impacts on how students perform in class, particularly students from groups who have been traditionally underrepresented, as you noted at the beginning. So I think that's a bit of a change. And also there's recent research talking more about how members of the LGBTQ population do in our classes. So we're getting beyond the content. And another big field, I would say, is the CURE, which is the course-based undergraduate research experience. And so that's taking authentic research, but bringing it into a course in the curriculum. It allows basically anybody to have a research experience and just register for a class. So it's much more inclusive. It's much more equitable. It doesn't require an application process. It doesn't require that you have X hours outside of your regularly scheduled class time to participate in research, allowing large numbers of students from all backgrounds to have that authentic undergraduate research experience and hopefully early in their undergraduate careers. And so there's been a lot of work done on CURES and developing CURES, assessing CURES and the impact of CURES. And so I think that's another sort of exciting development in the field.
That seems incredibly exciting. And are the data showing that this has been successful?
Yes. So we've actually published a paper on a CURE that we developed at NMSU, and our data were consistent with others in that we did a pre-survey at the beginning of class and a post-survey at the end of class, where we looked at various measures of scientific self-efficacy, sort of self-confidence with science, a sense of belonging to science, and an intention to persist. And we saw significant increases over the course of the CURE in all of those measures. When we look 1 year out after students have finished the CURE and it's 1 year later, students who participated in the CURE are more likely to still be in a STEM major compared to students who didn't take the CURE. There do seem to be a lot of positive outcomes, at least in that sort of 1 year post-CURE interval and within the CURE in terms of like confidence and belonging to STEM.
Are most institutions adopting it as a strategy in the field?
I think many are. So one thing is, if you have a CURE, to what extent is it required? To what extent can you make it required versus it's an option for students? For us, it's still in the category of it's an option for students.
Okay.
And then the other thing is, there's sort of two major categories of CURES. So the model we've been using is a particular faculty member will run the CURE course and students will work on some aspect of that faculty member's research. So for example, perhaps there is a known set of, a set of genes that's been identified in a screen. as maybe having something to do with eye development in flies, like Dr. Jen Curtis did. And she doesn't have time to look at all of those genes. So students in the CURE class could pick a gene, research it, and start to do some experiments to see, you know, does that gene have an impact in the development of eyes in fruit flies? And so they were actually doing research related to her research program. And when, if a paper were to come out, the students in the CURE course would be authors. So that's one model where it's sort of the faculty-driven research model. At certain places where faculty do not have large research programs or don't have an allocation of effort to research, that's a little bit more challenging. So there are other cures that are more, I don't want to say off the shelf or boxed, but they're sort of off the shelf or boxed. So for example, there's one called the C phages that has been heavily developed and sponsored by HHMI. And in that one, students isolate bacteriophages, little viruses that infect bacteria, from their local environment. And then they can, so they can isolate them, and then they can be sent off, and the genome of the phage can be sequenced, and then the students can analyze the genetics of that particular phage. There's another one that does a similar approach, but to isolate potentially antibiotic producing bacteria from soil. So they generate soil isolates of bacteria, look to see whether or not they produce antibiotics that then could be like a useful drug in the future. And I know that the New Mexico InBrave program has used that model in a boot camp for students from some of the smaller institutions around the state, come to NMSU for the summer and do that kind of a CURE experience for summer research.
That's exciting. And interviewed somebody for this podcast several months ago that talked about the CURE. Bernadette Connors was our second interview in the podcast series. So thanks, Michelle. I want to go back to something else you said. I think it's really interesting because I think a lot of times when we think about what we used to call diversity and equity in the classroom, but you remind us is really inclusive teaching, right? That's how we're talking about it now, is we often do think about content, right? That's kind of the first place we go. But one of the things you talked about is we're going beyond content, right? And you talked about stereotype threat. So can you talk a little bit about that?
A little. That's not my expertise. So to those who are experts, please forgive me for what's about to come out of my mouth. So stereotype threat is basically when members of an underrepresented group kind of become more aware of that and of their potential to fail simply because of who they are. For example, just by writing your name on the exam paper, if you have a Hispanic surname and it's a math test and you're taught that Hispanic people do not do as well in math, that's enough to impact your performance. And so there are different strategies that have been used to try and sort of mitigate this. So for example, instead of saying, this is going to be a really hard test, I could say, you guys have been prepared. We've worked hard together. You've all done this prep work, and even just some language like that can be enough to make everyone feel like, okay, I'm prepared for this test. Or there's different sorts of values affirmation exercises that can be done that can help sort of both relieve anxiety and mitigate stereotype threat. So it's a short writing exercise, maybe once or twice during the semester. And just that short writing exercise where you write about your values and things that are important to you seems to help boost the performance, for example, of women in a physics course.
As you know, I work at a community college. And one of the things that we talk a lot about is a lot of times kind of, and maybe historically, we forget that people who come to classes, to our classes, come to our institutions, bring with them a set of skills. And that there are times when we have to remind them they have skills and how do they adapt those skills to the situation that they're in. And then for ourselves, for us not to be driven by these stereotypes either, right? You ask us, just in giving us the examples, you ask us to think about that, but then you give us very precise examples that in terms of how we can counter that in our classrooms. So thank you. Those are really great examples. I'd like to move more specifically to your classroom, Michelle. Some very specific things that I've been interested in for a while and now have the great fortune to ask you about as part of your commitment to both student success and to equity in the classroom, inclusive teaching. There are things that you've done. And I want to ask very specifically about a couple of those, specifically data and then interventions that have been responsive to the data. But, you know, I'd like to talk about the language that we use to talk about inclusive teaching equity in higher education is contested and complicated. I don't know that we've settled on language entirely that feels comfortable to use. Phrases like achievement gap. So for a long time, we've talked about the achievement gap of certain populations in higher education. And so then we hear people talk about equity gap or opportunity gap. So I guess I'm interested, Michelle, about how you think about those terms as an educator interested in inclusive teaching.
I agree. It is incredibly important that we consider language and sort of the impact and implications of the language that we choose to use. And I have to say, I feel somewhat uncomfortable speaking to a linguistics expert about language, but nevertheless, here we go. So, when I think about an achievement gap, or maybe a little softer, a performance gap, so that is a thing that can be measured. We can say the average score of this group of students was that, the average score of the other group of students was this. And so achievement gaps or performance gaps, you can think of them as an output. Certain groups of students have a lower exam score than other groups. But I think the problem is if we say there's an achievement gap or a performance gap and certain students have performed less well, that language suggests that the problem was with the students because they didn't perform as well as the other students. On the one hand, you can say it's an objective measure of the difference in performance, but it seems to place the onus on the student to fix the problem. So when people use opportunity gap, that is then thinking about like the input. What has led to this output that we're observing, right? You may have lower rates of high school graduation. You may have different test scores. You may have different rates of university entrance. But what caused that? What happened before that to make this happen? When you think about it that way, if you use opportunity gap as this input, then it takes the burden off the student. There may be differences in prior access to high quality teaching materials or high quality curricula. Even the way that we structure our classrooms can create unintentional barriers to certain groups of students in our classrooms. And so I think when we say opportunity gap, then it puts the onus on the system, like the whole system. I mean, my little piece of the puzzle, I feel like, is make my classroom environment such that all students have the opportunity to succeed. And then I'm not doing something that I might think is doing it for a good reason, potentially, but I haven't thought through like all of the implications. So I feel like that opportunity gap puts the onus back on us where it belongs, not on the students who are subject to the opportunities that they did or didn't receive.
I think you're exactly right that often achievement gap or performance gap really has focused it on the student. In some ways, it's connected to facts. If you think about performance gap, it's like, here's a measure of performance. Here's a measure of performance. There's a difference that appears to be a gap. There's some fact that's connected to. But as you know, language is never that simple, right? Language is complicated. The philosophic underpinnings or the commitments we have to certain sort of language use alters those facts. And so this idea that it's focused on the problem is the student and not the institution. And I guess 2 or 3 years ago, I was working with someone on a grant. On this grant, the HSI STEM Hub, and it was clear that agencies were starting to think about this. And basically, I think in a lot of the grant language was, no, institutions, you have a group of students, it's your responsibility to respond to the group of students. For me, that's a pretty big shift. Let's not fix the students, let's create an opportunity where students have the opportunity, to use the same word, to develop the skills that they may or may not have gotten.
And I also feel like we have accepted these students. It is our responsibility now to make sure that we do everything we can to ensure that they have the opportunity to succeed. Right. I don't think we can guarantee that every single student is going to succeed, but we can certainly do everything in our power to provide those opportunities for our students who we accepted.
Our goal is really to create an environment where students can take this, what they bring with them, and further develop. It makes me think of another interview. Alexis Roselles, who we interviewed for the very first podcast in the series, is this idea of him working with students and trying to think about what's the relationship between what he's teaching and the communities from which they come, how to connect them.
We just talked about like word choice, right? Sort of. But the other thing I've been thinking about recently is language that we as instructors use in our classrooms, which I think can really influence the classroom environment. And in particular, I've really been looking at its work that comes out of Kimberly Tanner's group, where she talks about something called instructor talk. And it's basically the non-content language that instructors use while they're teaching. She has started to develop a framework so we can recognize categories of instructor talk. And there's some literature that would suggest that this kind of talk should influence the classroom environment and students' success in your classroom. But there's still, I think we're at the beginning of this phase of research, at least within STEM. The first two papers from her group on this, you know, there's examples of instructor talk that could either mitigate or enhance stereotype threat. And there's examples that could promote instructor immediacy, which makes instructors more sort of accessible to students, or it could create a barrier between the students and the instructor. Or you could use instructor talk to help foster buy-in to why you're using a different instructional technique than just lecturing at students, which they may have been used to. And so I sort of feel like this other level of language is the non-content language we were using in our class. And can we be more aware of that and the potential impacts on that classroom environment for our students? I think that's really interesting. And I'm starting to think a lot more about that in the last just couple months even.
It goes back to the previous question, Michelle, where you were talking about that we're going beyond content. I mean, I think a lot of times people get PhDs or master's degrees and are interested in the content of their field. That's what they're enthusiastic about.
Exactly.
I think the examples that you've provided really speak to the power of scholarly teaching and the power of the scholarship of teaching. I've heard you talk on a number of occasions about the way that you use data in your classroom to guide your teaching strategies, to understand what's happening with your students and to guide your teaching strategies. And I've heard you talk about these in really specific ways in terms of trying to create a more inclusive classroom. So can you walk us through some examples of the way that you use data in your classroom to understand what's going on and then ultimately to guide your next strategy?
So this is sort of another pathway. And so this is the pathway of one of our intro courses. It was Biology 211, now it's Biology 2110. It's the cell and molecular version of introductory biology. And so we've historically taught it in a very large lecture hall, like 350 students, more or less traditional lecture. I call that the bad old days. We had low pass rates overall, and we had enormous performance gaps between students who were traditionally underrepresented in STEM and the students who were not. It was not good overall, right? It was nothing to be proud of. So, you know, I'd heard about clickers in the earliest days of clicker technology. So those sort of individual response systems. And so I introduced clickers. And at the time, with that then clicker technology, it was challenging to run clickers in a very large classroom. And they were using infrared instead of radio frequency, blah, blah, blah. So I did clickers, and it seemed like students loved them. On the student evaluation, so I use student evaluations as one of my forms of evidence. I look at overall performance and gaps and overall pass rate. So I sort of try and triangulate. And then I also, frankly, use my own sort of gut instincts. I've been teaching for a long time, and I feel like I shouldn't ignore my own sense of how things are going. So I sort of try and triangulate different sources of data. So with the clickers, students seem to like them. But when I just looked at, you know, the average score at the end of the semester and the overall pass rate, it didn't seem like it was pushing the needle, right? And I'm like, why am I doing this? Dragging all this stuff around campus, blah, blah, blah. And so I mentioned this to a former colleague who's since retired, Ralph Ressler, and he was sort of curious, well, gosh, I mean, something must be happening with clickers. And so he was an ecologist, so he had different ways of thinking about experimental design. And so we actually ended up designing a study, and we had two faculty who collaborated. And basically what we did is we took all the lectures in the semester, and we randomly assigned them to either use a low number of clicker questions, a medium number of clicker questions, or a high number of. So we basically changed the intensity of clickers across different days at random. And then because these are large intro classes, it's all multiple choice exams. So we could take individual exam questions and say, all right, this collection of questions is all related to content from a low clicker day. this set of questions was from medium and this set of questions was from high. And what we found is there is a correlation between clicker intensity and how well they did on the related exam questions. So the more clicker questions we asked, the better they did on that corresponding material. And so what I learned from that is I just hammer them with clicker questions. And when I do clicker questions, there's other people who've done research to show that it's really students talking during the clicker questions that's driving the learning. So it's a peer activity, right? If you use clicker strictly as quizzing, I don't think you're getting the same learning as when students collaborate and talk and think about the clicker questions. So I think the clickers are not only breaking up the lecture, but they're giving students an opportunity to really think and teach each other about the material. So we added the clickers. Now I feel better about using them because I can see like the more tangible benefits, right?
Wow.
And then I said, well, what else can we do? And so I introduced case studies, which are basically authentic scenarios that you introduce, and they can reinforce the content. They can help students apply the content, have students make decisions about the content. And so I first introduced case studies in when I was teaching like 350 students in one lecture hall. There's me and a TA, and we're like, running around, there's no center aisle. We're running around trying to help students through this case study. The TA had to grade all of them. Still feel really bad about that. But on the student evaluations, I always have a question that says, compared to the beginning of the class, what is your current interest in biology? And it can be like much higher, higher, about the same, lower, much lower. And when we introduced those case studies, that question went way up. Their interest was higher and much higher, much more so than in prior semesters. I'm like, well, that's an important factor in retention and persistence. So I'm keeping the case studies, but like we're going to die if it's just two of us doing the case study. And so then what we did is we added our peer facilitators. And in biology, we call those the BioCATs, which stands for Biology Learning Catalysts. So the idea is they catalyze the learning. So they're fellow peers who've taken the class before, and they can help run around the room and help students. The other thing that the BioCATs do besides just provide help is they introduce more diversity into the instructional team. So we have BioCATs who are males, we have BioCATs who are Hispanic, we have BioCATs who are Black, we have BioCATs who speak Spanish. And so I think the students perhaps feel a little more comfortable to have that more diverse instructional team, right? Plus they're all closer in age mostly to the students than I am, right? When we introduced the BioCATs, it just made everything easier and I could do more case studies in the semester. So that seemed like a good thing. And as we did that, our performance gaps were narrowing. Our final transition with this course was through a stroke of I don't know what, fabulous good luck and lightning and the stars converged as part of an extensive renovation to our central teaching building on campus. We were able to build a TEAL classroom. So technology enhanced active learning classroom. They're also known as active learning classrooms or studio classrooms. So students sit at round tables. It's not tiered seating. All the walls are painted with whiteboard paint so they can get up and write on the walls. We can easily circulate. The BioCATs don't have to like break their knees, get in between rows. And when we went to the TEAL classroom, it just makes it so much easier to do all kinds of active learning or formative assessment kinds of activities, collaborative activities where we know collaboration helps drive learning. And so you're automatically sort of upping your ante in that area because it's really uncomfortable to stand in the middle of your room and lecture when by definition, your back is facing half the class at any given moment because the instructor's in the middle, right? So it's so awkward to do long lectures that you do mini lectures and then break it up with stuff. Between the environment matching the teaching strategy, lots of experience and practice, our performance gaps went from 17.2% gap in the pass rate to, I believe, we're now at about 7%. So we have not closed it, but we have narrowed it. And our DFW rates for all students have dropped substantially. So I think even some students who are not necessarily passing, they're still sticking with us. Our W rates have dropped by 85%.
Wow.
And so I think students are willing to stick with us because we are trying, right? We're making it engaging. And so now what I'm doing is trying to work more on the inclusivity piece, especially with, you know, what we've been through with COVID. So, you know, adding that flexibility, which doesn't hurt me, doesn't hurt anybody, but it helps lots of students who need that little bit of extra flexibility. For case study activities, where I want to make sure everyone's going to get the most out of it, I assign sort of a pre-class preparation assignment for everybody. Some students may be able to finish it quicker or more easily than other students, but any student can get help with it. But that means when we come to class on case study day, like I've tried to set it up so everyone's coming in starting at the same place, right? It doesn't matter where you went to high school. Everyone's done the same prep assignment. Everyone's had the chance to get it cleared up, and then we can all move forward from that place. So we're hoping to continue to sort of measure our pass rates and our gaps, not to blame the student, but to monitor what we're doing and is it still continuing to have a positive impact. So I use it to say, is what I'm doing making a difference that I can somehow measure? And then we also do look at the student evaluations. The students do have the opportunity to comment on things like equity and inclusivity. And while not many do, there are a few students who do seem to actually notice and appreciate the kinds of things that we're doing in that realm. So it allows me to continue to think about what can I do to make it easier for my students to show me what they can do, because I know they can do it.
You gave us like five examples, right?
But it's one course. Like that's one course over like 15 years.
Right. But that's impressive. Pre-class preparation, but Clicker plus peer exchange, case studies, BioCats, and then a studio classroom, or what we call it in MSU, a teal classroom. Those are really nice examples. But the piece, which is where part of the question came from, is the idea of using data to help you understand how interventions are working, right? How a strategy is working in the classroom. An 85% drop rate in W's, that's got to be unheard of. You're seeing all performance go up, and you're seeing a reduction in what we're calling, for purposes of this conversation, kind of performance gap on certain measures.
Just pass rates, really.
On pass rates.
So the percent of students earning an A, B, or a C.
Now, if I were listening to this interview, Michelle, I would say that some of these changes, some of these interventions can be done on the part of a faculty member who's interested. It also sounds like there's some institutional resources that are important to support this sort of really positive and productive change in a classroom. Talk to us a little bit about institutional investment required to do this sort of work, to really move the data needle on gaps. What do department heads, deans, provosts, VPRRs, and presidents need to be thinking about and committing to?
So I would say the first thing is they need to make sure that the appropriate people, like the instructors, actually have access to the data. The institution needs to be prepared to pilot initiatives. In our case, we were lucky to have grant money that allowed that piloting to happen. But then I think in the case where something has been shown to be successful, then I think it's important for the institution to then take ownership and sustain it. And I understand there are budgetary constraints, but it's really important to do our best to sustain successful initiatives to the extent that we can. If we can't sustain them at the full level that we were doing them, then let's keep monitoring the data and see if we do a reduced level, you know, what's the impact. The other thing I would say is to be patient. Don't do a one semester pilot and decide it didn't work. It can take time to implement, evaluate, tweak, repeat, for the instructor to learn how to do something differently than they have been doing, for students to get used to doing something differently. So I would say it's not like a one semester, try it and give up. It's probably two academic years for something that's challenging, right? Research takes that long. So might this. And then also, sometimes when someone tries something new and they're not as experienced in it, it may not go great the first time. And so don't punish faculty for trying. If their evaluations drop a little bit, for example, because something wasn't as smooth as silk the first time they tried it, don't punish them. Give them credit for trying, and then, you know, make sure that they have the resources. Like, who can we send you to a workshop? Can you talk to someone? Can we send someone into your class to do observations? Let's work on this as a team. If someone is trying something new, whether they're doing it independently or collaboratively, give them some space to do it. If the institution or a faculty member, whomever, is going to try a strategy from the literature, right, like an evidence-based or research-based strategy, let's do our best to do a full, complete fidelity replication. If what was successful at some other institution required, you know, that you hire a certain number of peer facilitators for every certain number of students, or that you also, you know, have prep meeting, like, do it. Start with how the literature says, even if it's going to be a little more expensive to make that investment, right? Because if you do something and you can only do it half measures and it doesn't work, we don't know if that's because it only works at an R1 institution and it doesn't work at a Hispanic serving institution. Or we don't know if it didn't work because we weren't able to do a full replication of the actual intervention. So I feel like there's a lot of the literature, and this is sort of coming out, a lot of the education, STEM education literature is being carried out at R1 institutions. And they're very different than, for example, New Mexico State University, even though we aspire to be an R1, or even Doña Ana Community College. And so sometimes you wonder, well, would that work here with our students and our population? I don't know. I mean, I'd be interested, right? But I would want, to the extent possible, to try and replicate what I read in the literature so I can at least try and do a side-by-side comparison.
So some of this is just flat out financial investment. We need to find dollars to invest in these strategies that have proven successful. Let's see if they can work at our institution. I think that's really critical. One of the things that's really interesting is to think strategically about these interventions. For example, if you think about BioCats, they fit this trajectory that you're talking about engagement, or really giving the faculty some resource so that they can do the work that needs to be done. They can use more of a particular strategy because they have these support, basically a support team to help the students engage. And it really diversifies the teaching team. The literature is pretty clear on that, that is helpful to students who come from underrepresented populations. And so it was really interesting to think about the robustness of the intervention. Yeah, it may be about content. Yeah, it may be about a teaching strategy, but it's also got this other feature to it that also has been shown to be important for students of color, certainly. And I would assume for women as well. And I would assume for LGBTQ students as well. So this kind of immense gain, when you think about an institution budget and you think about if we were to put BioCats in this set of circumstance, in this critical class, the cost is probably relatively small when you think of an institutional budget. Those are the kinds of things that we need to be thinking about that often get purchased through grants and that we need to make sure we sustain them past the grants. The other thing that I thought was really important in terms of institutional investment that you raised was this idea that we have policies and procedures and longstanding conventions like promotion and tenure, like annual evaluation of faculty, and that you ask institutions, I think, to think differently about those processes and how to support faculty who are trying to develop new, more inclusive ways of teaching. I think a lot of times when you think about investment, we think financial, right? Because that's how we're set up to think about it. But there's some sort of institutional, organizational investment that makes sense as well. And we should not forget about that part.
Yeah. I mean, even just sort of to use that word flexibility again, be a little bit flexible in how we do an evaluation of teaching when someone's in the middle of like a major revamp, for example.
Right.
And ask perhaps more of that faculty to describe exactly what you're doing and why you're doing it. Like put a little more pressure on them. Why you're doing this, why it's worthwhile. Tell me exactly what you're doing. And then it's like, great. You're doing all this extra work in your teaching. You've brought in the literature. I got no problem if we keep going down this path for a year or two and see where it takes us.
That's fantastic. It does ask us to make our foundation for the work we do student success. I mean, that sounds obvious to say that, but it's not always obvious because I don't think our policies and procedures and our conventions are always based on that. I feel like the system we work for is really working to foreground that. And across the country, obviously, agencies, funding agencies are thinking about that. Professional organizations are thinking about that. You remind us, how do we foreground that in terms of the decision-making that we do, not just in the classroom, but obviously across the institution, how we set up our data structures, how we set up our funding structures in terms of sustainability. Well, Michelle, that was the last question I had, other than, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I'd just like to thank you for the opportunity to have this conversation with you. It's been great fun.
You know what? It's been fun. It's been incredibly instructive for me, Michelle. As a lifelong educator myself, you've prompted me to think about all sorts of things, even though I'm not in STEM, but things I should be thinking about as an administrator in higher ed. So really, thank you for spending time with us today.
I love talking teaching.
It was really fun and thoughtful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to STEMversity, the podcast. We appreciate your interest in being part of the conversation on supporting student success in STEM. please visit www.hsistemhub.org and join our STEM Professionals Network for more information, materials, and announcements. There is no fee to join. Connect with the HSI STEM Hub on LinkedIn and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date information for STEM education at HSI. Please subscribe, share, and review the podcast to keep the conversation going. This podcast is produced by the NSF HSI National STEM Resource Hub, funded by the National Science Foundation, awards 1-832-338 and 1-832-345. Music by Elijah Vela. Any opinions, findings, conclusions, or recommendations presented in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the National Science Foundation, NMSU, CSUN, or DACC.